Good morning. You're listening to the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service, and this is the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, June 27th. We'll begin with the weather. Today it says brilliant sunshine and very nice, high of 85. And then for tonight, a starry night and a low of 61. For Tuesday, breezy in the morning, mostly sunny, a high of 92 and a low of 63. For Wednesday, mostly sunny, becoming windy and hot, high of 95 and a low of 72. Then for Thursday, hot, breezy in the morning, high of 93 and a low of 63. Then for Friday, a little bit of a cool down, not as hot, with clouds and sun, high of 83 and a low of 61. Sunrise this morning was at 5:51 a.m. and sunset this evening will be at 9:07 p.m. For Tuesday, sunrise at 5:51 and sunset at 9:07. The mini editorial today is from the Journal editorial board, and it simply says, "Thank you, Siouxlanders, for holding back on the late night fireworks. In previous years, we would have been complaining by now." The first front page story is a preview of tonight's Sioux City City Council meeting. The headline says, "Council may rein in after-hours clubs." The Sioux City Council will be asked Monday to adopt an ordinance that would require after-hours clubs within city limits to be licensed. The ordinance would allow the city to regulate places that operate between 2 and 6 a.m. for the purpose of entertainment, social gathering, dancing, live or recorded music, or playing games of skill or chance. Over the past several years, these types of clubs have been the site of multiple shootings and other criminal activity. In the early morning hours of October 10th, officers were dispatched to a shots fired call at an after-hours club at 427 Pierce Street, where they found a male victim with a life-threatening gunshot wound to his upper body. A short time later, three other victims arrived at hospitals with non-life-threatening injuries. The shooting was the result of a dispute between two groups of people at the club, which has since closed, according to police. Sioux City Police Detective Josh Tyler told the Journal, "We've had homicides, we've had shootings, physical disturbances are pretty common. There's been allegations of gambling and drug use and or sales at these places." Tyler said he is aware of only one after-hours club in the city, but he said the city has had as many as three after-hours clubs operating at one time. If the proposed ordinance is adopted, existing clubs would be granted a temporary license to continue operating for 100 days after the ordinance goes into effect. Then they would have to conform to and abide by the ordinance. Tyler said, "Right now we have a business that's trying to operate under this. This has nothing to do with this particular business." He then added, "Nationally, after-hours clubs are problematic during those hours. This is more of a preventative measure." Tyler likened the way after-hours clubs operate to a house party. Since there is no specific ordinance in place to regulate them, the clubs aren't subject to the same checks and balances as establishments that have liquor licenses. Tyler said, "Right now, they are not as problematic as they were. For a duration of time, I would say that they were a regular issue for the night shift officers. You find that it's typically the same group of people that are managing them. It's a group of four or five individuals that, today it's my club, and then the next month it's your club." Under the proposed ordinance, after-hours club owners would be required to pay $175 to apply for or renew a license, which would be valid for a period of 1 year. As a condition of the application, owners would consent to allowing the city's inspection services and fire departments to inspect the premises to confirm compliance with city code standards. Licensees would also have to carry liability insurance. Police officers would be allowed to enter the clubs during operating hours to confirm that alcoholic beverage laws were being complied with. under the city code, consumption of alcoholic beverages on premises accessible to the public is prohibited from 2 to 6 a.m. on weekdays and Saturdays and from 2 to 8 a.m. on Sundays. No one under 21 would be permitted in an after-hours club during hours of operation. The clubs could not be located in areas of the city that are zoned residential or operate within any premises that has a liquor license. An after-hours club in violation of the ordinance would be declared a nuisance, and the owner of the premises at which it operates would be guilty of a municipal infraction, according to the proposed ordinance. Its license would be suspended if the licensee or the licensee's employee, agent, or contractor committed a, quote, specific criminal incident at the club or recklessly allowed one to occur there or was ordered to abate a nuisance at the club. An after-hours club's license would be revoked if the licensee or the licensee's employee, agent, or contractor committed or knowingly allowed another to commit murder or voluntary manslaughter. The license would also be terminated if the club's license had been suspended within the previous 12 months and the licensee or the licensee's employee, agent, or contractor once again committed a criminal incident or knowingly allowed one to occur. Under the proposed ordinance, the city manager would issue a letter of intent to deny, suspend, or revoke an after-hours club's license. Licensees would be allowed to request a hearing to contest any denial, suspension, or revocation within 20 days of the date of the letter. Also on the front page is a story headlined, Parading to Sioux City, Mardi Gras Parade Returning to Downtown on Friday. And there is a little box here that says it begins Friday at 6 p.m. The parade route starts inside of the parking lot at the Tyson Event Center and will then move to Pierce Street, turning right onto 4th Street, and will end on Iowa Street. The story is by Earl Horlick. For more than 25 years, Blaine Bourgeois has made the trek between his hometown of Lake Charles, Louisiana, to its sister city of Sioux City, which is a little more than 1,000 miles away. However, this year, the professional photographer will be making the trip by car. I'll be going with a buddy and we'll eat at as many small-town diners as possible, Bourgeois explained. After a stopover in Kansas City, we'll be in Sioux City in about 18 hours. This gives Bourgeois enough time to enjoy Sioux City's Mardi Gras parade, which will return at 6 p.m. Friday. The route begins at the Tyson Event Center on Gordon Drive before making a turn out of the parking lot on Pierce Street to 4th Street, ending on Iowa Street. In 1995, Lake Charles became Sioux City's sister city, allowing the two similarly sized communities the chance to exchange cultures and traditions. Except for the pandemic year of 2020, the Big Parade and Mardi Gras Festival costume show have been summertime mainstays for Sioux City. While the Crew de Charlie Sioux Mardi Gras Parade made a comeback in the summer of 2021, the costume show did not. Similarly, this year's event will consist solely of the parade. Bourgeois said, "Sadly, I think the costume show may be a thing of the past. While we will have 6 to 8 Lake Charles people in town, they won't be bringing all of the costumes as before." Indeed, much of the elaborate costuming and displays had been damaged after Lake Charles experienced unprecedented flooding in 2021. More significantly, many of Lake Charles' parties of representatives are getting older. Bourgeois said, "When I started coming to Sioux City, I was considered the kid of the crew. The kid is now in his 60s. Which doesn't mean that Bourgeois would ever give up partying with his sister city friends. I'm not a Facebooker myself, but I know many Lake Charles people stay in contact with Sioux Citians on both Mardi Gras and non-Mardi Gras activities throughout the year. An annual trip to Sioux City has become a favorite tradition for them," he said. That is a sentiment shared by many Siouxland residents, according to Tyson Event Center's Enzo Caronante. Enzo said, since the Mardi Gras parade takes place the day before Saturday in the park, it also serves as a kickoff for a long weekend of fun events in Sioux City, which is more important this year than ever before. Enzo said, with the high price of gasoline, people are looking for ways to have fun locally. The Mardi Gras parade and Saturday in the park are great staycation opportunities. For bourgeois, the Mardi Gras parade is a way to bring a bit of Louisiana culture to the Midwest. He said, when we first started coming to the Sioux City parade, I'm sure a lot of people thought we were crazy. Why are those Lake Charles people throwing beads at us instead of candy? Despite that, Sioux Cityans quickly caught on to the charms of Mardi Gras. Bourgeois said he and his fellow Lake Charlesers were similarly impressed by Siouxland. Between their Mardi Gras parade and Saturday in the park, Sioux Cityans like to have fun, he said. One other front page story of local interest is headlined, Christy Noem says, restrict abortion pills but don't punish women. South Dakota's Republican governor pledged on Sunday to bar mail-order abortion pills, but said women should not face prosecution for seeking them. In apparent defiance of legal guidance by the Justice Department after the Supreme Court last week stripped away women's constitutional protection for abortion, Christy Noem indicated in national television interviews that she would put in place a plan approved by state lawmakers to restrict the pills. The majority ruling Friday by the court's conservative justices triggered abortion bans in South Dakota and elsewhere. But Noem said doctors, not their patients, would likely be prosecuted for knowing violation of what would be one of the strictest laws on abortion pills in the United States. I don't believe women should ever be prosecuted, she said. I don't believe there should be any punishment for women ever that are in a crisis situation or have an unplanned pregnancy. At issue is mail order or so-called telemedicine abortion pills, which have been on the rise in the country since 2000 when the Food and Drug Administration approved mifepristone, the main drug used in medication abortions. More than 90% of abortions take place in the first 13 weeks of pregnancy, and more than half are now done with pills, not surgery, according to data compiled by the Guttmacher Institute, a research group that supports abortion rights. Abortion pills are expected to become in higher demand as over half the states are likely to now move to ban abortions following the Supreme Court's decision. Noem, a strong opponent of abortion rights, who faces re-election in November and is mentioned as a possible 2024 presidential contender, cast the distribution of abortion pills as unsafe and has called a special session to craft new laws. Noem said, these are very dangerous medical procedures. We don't believe it should be available because it is a dangerous situation for those individuals without being medically supervised by a physician. In a state where Republicans hold supermajorities in both state house chambers, South Dakota lawmakers have been floating proposals that also would make it more difficult for women to seek an abortion out of state. South Dakota voters rejected outright bans in 2006 and 2008, and abortion rights advocates are preparing for a similar referendum on abortion access. In a statement Friday, President Joe Biden's Attorney General Merrick Garland said the Justice Department will protect abortion providers and those seeking abortions in states where it is legal and will work with other arms of the federal government that seek to use their lawful authorities to protect and preserve access to reproductive care. In particular, the FDA has approved the use of the medication mifepristone, Garland added. States may not ban mifepristone based on disagreement with the FDA's expert judgment about its safety and efficacy. Continuing with that topic, there is a story inside headlined, Some Women Fear Setback to Hard-Won Legal Rights. This is an Associated Press story. At 88, Gloria Steinem has long been the nation's most visible feminist and advocate for women's rights. But at 22, she was a frightened American in London getting an illegal abortion of a pregnancy unwanted. She actually tried to throw herself down the stairs to end it. Her response to the Supreme Court's decision overruling Roe v. Wade is succinct. Obviously, she wrote in an email message, without the right of women and men to make decisions about our own bodies, there is no democracy. Steinem's blunt remark cuts to the heart of the despair some opponents are feeling about Friday's historic rollback of the 1973 case legalizing abortion. If a right so central to the overall fight for women's equality can be revoked, they ask, what does it mean for the progress women have made in public life in the intervening 50 years? Debbie Walsh of the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers said, one of the things that I keep hearing from women is, my daughter's going to have fewer rights than I did, and how can that be? If this goes, what else can go? It makes everything feel precarious. Reproductive freedom was not the only demand of second-wave feminism, as the women's movement of the 60s and 70s is known, but it was surely one of the most galvanizing issues along with workplace equality. The women who fought for those rights recall an astonishing decade of progress from about 1963 to 1973, including the right to equal pay, the right to use birth control, and Title IX in 1972, which bans discrimination in education. Capping it off was Roe v. Wade a year later, granting a constitutional right to abortion. Many of the women who identified as feminists at the time had an illegal abortion or knew someone who did. Steinem, in fact, credits a speak-out meeting she attended on abortion in her 30s as the moment she pivoted from journalism to activism and finally felt enabled to speak about her own secret abortion. Carol Jaffe, a sociologist at the University of Southern California in San Francisco, said, abortion is so tied to the women's movement in this country. Along with improved birth control, what legal abortion meant was that women who were heterosexually active could still take part in public life. It enabled the huge change we've seen in women's status over the last 50 years. Jaffe says, of many women like her now feel that the right to contraception could be at risk, something she calls unthinkable. One of them is Heather Booth. When she was 20 and a student in Chicago, a male friend asked if she could help his sister obtain an abortion. It was 1965, and through contacts in the civil rights movement, she found a way to connect the young woman, nearly suicidal at the prospect of being pregnant, to a doctor willing to help. She thought it would be a one-off, but Booth ended up co-founding the Jane Collective, an underground group of women who provided safe abortions to those in need. In all, the group performed some 11,000 abortions over 7 years, according to a story recounted in the new documentary, The Janes. Booth, now 76, sees the Roe v. Wade upheaval as a chilling challenge to the triumphs of the women's movement. I think we are on a knife's edge, she says. On the one hand, there's been 50 years of a change in women's condition in this society, she adds, recalling that when she was growing up, women could only respond to employment ads in the women's section, to list just one example. And then she goes on to say, so there's been an advance toward greater equality, but if you ask about where we stand, I think we are on a knife's edge, in a contest really between democracy and freedom and tyranny, a dismantling of freedoms that have been long fought for. Of course, not every woman feels that abortion is a right worth preserving. Linda Sloan, who has volunteered the last 5 years, along with her husband, for the anti-abortion organization A Moment of Hope in Columbia, South Carolina, says she values women's rights. I strongly believe and support women being treated as equals to men in job opportunities, salary, respect, and many other areas, she says. She says she has tried to instill those values in her two daughters and her two sons, and upholds them with her work at two women's shelters, trying to empower women to make the right choices. But when it comes to Roe v. Wade, she says, "I believe that the rights of the child in the mother's womb are equally important. To quote Psalm 139, I believe that God formed my inner parts and knitted me together in my mother's womb." Elizabeth Kilmartin, like Sloan, volunteers at a moment of hope and is deeply pleased by the court's decision. In her younger years, she considered herself a feminist and studied women's history in college. Then, over the years, she came to deeply oppose abortion and no longer considers herself a feminist because she believes the word has been co-opted by those on the left. She said, "No women's rights have been harmed in the decision to stop killing babies in the womb. We have all kinds of women in power. Women aren't being oppressed in the workplace anymore. We have a woman vice president. It's just ridiculous to think that we are oppressed." Cheryl Lambert falls squarely in the opposing camp. The former Wall Street executive, now 65, immediately thought back to the gains she made earlier in her banking career, becoming the first woman to be named an officer at the institution she worked for. She calls the court's decision a sucker punch. And then Lambert says, "My thought was, what era are we living in? We are moving backwards. I'm just furious on behalf of our children and our grandchildren." Next up are a couple of stories on the economy and gas prices. The first is headlined, "Experts say gas tax holiday would worsen inflation. Iowa consumers pay over 48 cents a gallon in taxes." Iowa drivers would save more than 18 cents per gallon on gasoline if federal lawmakers paused the federal gas tax, and another 30 cents per gallon if the state did the same. But not all lawmakers agree a tax holiday is a productive way to provide relief to consumers who are being impacted by inflation. Some experts warn it could make inflation even worse. The average cost Saturday for a gallon of gas in Iowa was $4.66 per gallon, according to AAA. The national average was $4.91. Earlier this year, the national average crept over the $5 mark for the first time ever. The federal government taxes every gallon of gas 18.4 cents and the state of Iowa 30 cents. If Congress or the Iowa legislature approved a temporary gas tax holiday, it would reduce the cost for a gallon of gas by that much. Democratic President Joe Biden on Wednesday called for a three-month federal gas tax holiday, and he called on states to do the same with their gas taxes. Biden said the temporary pause would give consumers some relief during the summer driving season. Biden said, "I fully understand that a gas tax holiday alone is not going to fix the problem, but it will provide families some immediate relief, just a little bit of breathing room, as we continue working to bring down prices for the long haul." Fuel taxes at both the state and federal level go into government accounts that fund infrastructure maintenance and construction. The Federal Highway Trust Fund collects roughly $38 billion in annual revenue from fuel taxes over the past 4 years, according to federal data. And Iowa's Road Use Tax Fund has collected between $640 and $700 million in annual revenue from fuel taxes over the past 6 years. Any suspension of fuel taxes would reduce revenue to those infrastructure funds. Biden is proposing that Congress use other federal revenue to ensure a gas tax holiday has no negative effect on the Federal Highway Trust Fund. But experts warn that pausing gas taxes could encourage people to drive more, which would increase demand for fuel and thus contribute even further to inflation. Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, said, "I'm not a fan. You want people to drive less and use less gas. This works against that objective." That's why Iowa U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley said he opposes a tax holiday. Grassley said, "These issues are only going to worsen the problem by stimulating consumer demand, or it's not going to reduce consumer demand, and in the process is going to reduce productivity." Pat Grassley, the senator's grandson and the Iowa House Speaker, said late in the recently concluded session of the Iowa legislature that he did not believe a gas tax holiday was a good idea because of the potential impact on state infrastructure revenue. Pat Grassley said, "I don't necessarily think that that's going to be on the table because at the same time, we have roads and bridges that all Iowans want us to continue to invest in, and to pause the state gas tax could potentially jeopardize those continued projects." Iowa increased its state gas tax by 10 cents per gallon in 2015. The State Transportation Department had requested the increase, citing a $215 million annual shortfall in infrastructure revenue. Both state and federal governments are grappling with how to address long-term infrastructure funding as cars become more fuel efficient or, in the case of electric vehicles, use no fuel at all. Total fuel consumption has been declining, leading to a gradual decline in fuel tax revenue, the state's nonpartisan fiscal service agency reported. In Iowa, road use tax fund revenues have decreased annually from the state's 2017 budget year of $699 million to the 2021 budget year $643 million, even though vehicle registration fees have increased over the same time, according to state data. Brings me just about halfway through the IRIS reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, June 27th. We'll move again to another gas story. This one is headlined, "Gas Prices Sting Workers Who Depend on Their Cars." This is bylined from Detroit. High gas prices have Wallace Reed looking for a new career. Reed, who drives for Uber and Lyft in New York, fills up his Lexus at least three times a week. He pays around $95 each time, about double what he was paying last year. To make up for that, he's driving more often, but he's also applying for other jobs that wouldn't require his car. Reed said, "It's more hours, more stress. New York City is not an easy city to work, and it's affecting our lives." Reed isn't alone. Millions of Americans who rely on their cars for work are changing their habits, signing up for carpools, or even ditching their cars for bicycles, as gas prices recently hit $5 per gallon for the first time ever. On Wednesday, President Joe Biden asked Congress to suspend federal gas taxes for 3 months, which would shave 18.4 cents per gallon off the price of gas. He also called on states to suspend their own gas taxes. Biden's push faces uphill odds in Congress. In the meantime, gas is straining budgets. Jace Schumacher Galloway agonized over whether to charge more for Paws and Whiskers Sitters, her pet sitting business in Macomb, Illinois. She visits as many as 10 houses each day and fills up her 2018 Mazda almost every week. One recent fill-up cost her nearly $50. This month, she finally acted. She contacted her clients and told them she was removing the 10% discount she has always given to repeat customers. Shoemaker Galloway, who is also a children's book author, said her customers were understanding, but she worries that gas prices will cut into her business in other ways. She said, "The cost isn't just impacting my bottom line. Because the price of everything is so expensive, people are cutting back on non-essentials, which means pet sitting and book sales. In a normal summer, Orvilia Nieto might do some traveling in the RV she lives in Lytle, Texas. But that might not happen this year. She is struggling to fill the tank of her 2008 Ford Expedition SUV so she can get to her job at a TJ Maxx distribution center in San Antonio, about 20 miles away. Nieto and her coworkers trade tips on where gas is cheapest. She sometimes carpools or fills her tank only halfway, which still costs her more than $50, but she feels lucky. A handful of colleagues on her shift, which ends at 2:30 a.m., ride their bikes home in the dark. It's been a rough road," she said. "If we lived in the city, it would be easier, we could take the bus, but at the end of the shift at 2:30 in the morning, what bus line is available? Jill Chapman, a senior performance consultant with Insperity, a Texas-based human resources and recruitment company, said gas prices and commute lengths are increasingly a sticking point with job candidates. Chapman said companies may want to consider temporary bonuses, incentives for public transit, or gas cars to help their employees. Chapman said a business owner needs to acknowledge that there is stress associated with rising gas prices. David Lewis, the CEO of Operations Incorporated, a Norwalk, Connecticut-based human resources consulting company, remembers handing out gas cards to his employees in 2009 when gas prices topped $4 per gallon. But this time he won't be doing that because employees have another option, working from home. Lewis said, "This is an unwelcome development for those companies that are trying to get people back to the office. It is one more reasonable reason why those employees are pushing back." Lewis has around 100 employees in Norwalk. Before COVID, 85% of them were in the office at least 2 days a week. Now, maybe 25% of them are. Lewis and many of his clients would like to see employees in the office more, but says gas prices are a huge barrier. He said, "If you are the company that requires everyone to come in all the time, you're a pariah." Psychology professor Brian Cesario used to live within walking distance of the college where he teaches, but last year he moved 55 miles away to Hopewell Junction, New York, so he could afford a larger home for his growing family. Cesario taught remotely even before the pandemic and assumed he would continue doing so, but last fall his college began requiring him to drive to campus twice a week, a commute that now costs him $240 in gas each month. Cesario said he doesn't make enough to compensate for that, so he's looking for a fully remote job outside of academia. For those who must commute, there can be options. On Tuesday, Uber announced it was bringing back discounted shared rides in 9 U.S. cities, including New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago. Organizations that link carpoolers, like One Run by the Southeast Michigan Council of Governments in the Detroit area, say they are seeing significantly more participants. Moving now to the world page, there are a couple of stories on Ukraine, the war in Ukraine. The first is headlined, "Biden Urges Unity on Ukraine," and this is bylined from Elmau, Germany. President Joe Biden and Western allies opened a 3-day summit in the Bavarian Alps on Sunday, intent on keeping economic fallout from the war in Ukraine from fracturing the global coalition working to punish Russia's aggression. Britain's Boris Johnson warned the leaders not to give in to fatigue, even as Russia lobbed new missiles at Kyiv. The group of seven leaders were set to announce new bans on imports of Russian gold, the latest in a series of sanctions the Club of Democracies hopes will further isolate Russia economically. They also were looking at possible price caps on energy meant to limit Russian oil and gas profits that Moscow can pump into its war effort. And following up on a proposal from the last year's G7 summit, Biden formally launched a global infrastructure partnership designed to counter China's influence in the developing world. The initiative aims to leverage $600 billion with fellow G7 countries by 2027 for global infrastructure projects. Some $200 billion would come from the United States. U.S. officials have long argued that China's infrastructure initiatives trap receiving countries in debt and that the investments benefit China more than their hosts. In a pre-summit show of force, Russia launched its first missile strikes against the Ukrainian capital in 3 weeks, striking at least 2 residential buildings, according to Kyiv Mayor Vitaly Klitschko. Biden said, "We have to stay together because Putin has been counting on from the beginning that somehow NATO and the G7 would splinter, but we haven't and we're not going to. Biden and his counterparts were using the gathering to discuss how to secure energy supplies and tackle inflation triggered by the war's fallout. The leaders also came together on the new global infrastructure partnership meant to provide alternatives to Russia and Chinese investment in the developing world. One by one, the leaders stepped up to the microphone to discuss the partnership and their roles in it, without mentioning China by name. Ukraine cast a shadow over the gathering, but the leaders were determined to project resolve. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz told Biden that the allies all managed to stay united, which obviously Putin never expected. Biden said of Putin's war, "We can't let this aggression take the form it has and get away with it." Scholz, who has faced criticism at home and abroad for perceived reluctance to send Ukraine heavy weapons, said, "Germany and the U.S. will always act together when it comes to questions of Ukraine's security." Boris Johnson, for his part, urged fellow leaders not to give in to, quote, fatigue. He has expressed concerns that divisions may emerge in the pro-Ukraine alliance as the four-month-old war grinds on. The other Ukraine story is bylined from Kyiv and is headlined, "Missile Strikes Shatter Relative Calm." Russia shattered weeks of relative calm in the Ukrainian capital with long-range missiles fired toward Kyiv early Sunday, an apparent Kremlin show of force as Western leaders meet in Europe to strengthen their military and economic support of Ukraine. Kyiv Mayor Vitaly Klitschko said the missiles hit at least two residential buildings, and President Volodymyr Zelensky said a 37-year-old man was killed and his 7-year-old daughter and wife injured. Associated Press journalists saw emergency workers battling flames and rescuing civilians. The strikes also damaged a nearby kindergarten where a crater pocked the courtyard. U.S. President Joe Biden called the attacks barbarism after he arrived in Germany for a Group of Seven summit. Later Sunday, a local official reported a second death, telling the Union news agency that a railroad worker was killed and several others injured in the attacks while servicing rail infrastructure. Ukrainian Air Force spokesman Yuri Ignat said the first air-launched weapons successfully to target the capital since June 5th were Kh-101 cruise missiles fired from warplanes over the Caspian Sea, more than 900 miles away. Kyiv's mayor told journalists he thought the airstrikes were maybe a symbolic attack ahead of a NATO summit in Madrid that starts Tuesday. A former commander of U.S. forces in Europe said the strikes were also a signal to the leaders of G7 nations meeting Sunday in Germany. Retired Lieutenant General Ben Hodges said, "Russia is saying, we can do this all day long. You guys are powerless to stop us. The Russians are humiliating the leaders of the West." The G7 leaders were set to announce the latest in a long series of international economic steps to pressure and isolate Russia over its war in Ukraine. New bans on imports of Russian gold, standing with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. The three-day meeting's host, Biden, said of the missile strikes on Kyiv, it's more of their barbarism. Zelensky, speaking in his nightly video address, appealed to the G7 leaders for more help, saying stopping Russian aggression is possible only if we get everything we ask for and in the time we need it, weapons, financial support, and sanctions against Russia. A Ukrainian parliament member, Oleksiy Goncharenko, wrote on the Telegram messaging app that preliminary information indicated that Russia launched 14 missiles toward the capital region and Kyiv itself. Zelensky said some were intercepted and he vowed revenge against all pilots, dispatchers, technicians, and other people who ensured the launch of missiles in Ukraine. "We will find you all," Zelensky said. "Each of you will be responsible for these blows. And if someone thinks he will evade responsibility by saying that this was an order, you are wrong. When your missiles hit homes, it's a war crime. The court is what awaits you all, and you will not hide anywhere, neither on the shores of the Caspian Sea, over which your missiles are launched, nor in Belarus, nowhere. In a phone interview, retired U.S. General Hodges told the Associated Press that Russia has a limited stock of precision missiles, and if they are using them, it's going to be for a special purpose. Russia has denied targeting civilians during the four-month war, and Hodges said it was hard to know if the missiles launched Sunday were intended to strike the apartment buildings. Russian forces tried to seize control of Kyiv earlier in the war. After Ukrainian troops repelled them, the Kremlin largely shifted its focus to southern and eastern Ukraine. Russian rocket strikes in the city of Cherkasy, about 100 miles southeast of Kyiv, killed one person and injured five, Regional Governor Thor Tarbritz said Sunday. In the east, Russian troops fought to consolidate their gains by battling to swallow up the last remaining Ukrainian stronghold in Luhansk province. Luhansk Governor Serhiy Hydai said Sunday that Russia was conducting intense airstrikes on the city of Lyshansk, destroying its television tower and seriously damaging a bridge. There's much destruction. Lyshansk is almost unrecognizable, Hydai said on Facebook. For weeks, Lyshansk and the nearby city of Severodonetsk have been subject to a bloody and destructive offensive by Russian forces and their separatist allies aimed at capturing all of Ukraine's eastern Donbas region. They have made steady and slow progress, with Hydai confirming Saturday that Severodonetsk, including a chemical plant where hundreds of Ukrainian troops and civilians were holed up, had fallen. Commenting on the battle for Severodonetsk, Russian Defense Ministry spokesman Igor Konashenkov said late Saturday that Russia and Moscow-backed separatist forces now control not only the city but the villages surrounding it. He said the Russian military had thwarted Ukrainian forces' attempt to turn the Azot chemical plant into a stubborn center of resistance. Capturing Lyshansk would give Russian and separatist forces control of every major settlement in Luhansk. At last report, they controlled about half of Donetsk, the second province in the Donbas. That pretty much covers news, so I'm going to move to the sports section. One here is headlined, "He Always Believed in Me." Keegan Murray credits McCaffrey with his development. Keegan Murray doesn't believe he would be in the position he is in today without the help of Iowa basketball coach Fran McCaffrey, and the Hawkeye staff. During a weekend introductory news conference in Sacramento, where the Kings made Murray the fourth overall selection in the NBA draft last weekend, Murray credited McCaffrey for seeing potential in the 6'8" forward that other coaches failed to realize. Murray said, "He always believed in me. I've played against both his kids in high school. We went to rival high school, so he was able to see my growth and development. He was the first coach who treated me and my twin brother Chris as individuals, so I think I give all credit to him and our coaching staff in just developing me." Murray also credited McCaffrey for, quote, "giving me the confidence just to go out every night knowing that if we win or lose, he can live with that, with me being the guy on their team. He just established great confidence in me, and I'm just forever grateful." That confidence has prepared Murray for a role with his new employer. Kings general manager Monty McNair said confidence was among the reasons Sacramento wanted Murray to be part of the rebuilding process for an organization which last played a postseason game in the NBA 16 years ago, a league record. McNair said, "We get 5 minutes to determine a draft selection following the previous pick, and I don't think we used anywhere near 5 minutes to call it in. For us, the joy was 100%. That was our whole front office as an organization, not just myself. The feeling was mutual. Murray believes his versatility on the court and his personality off the court fits in well with what McNair and new Kings coach Mike Brown envision as they work to build a team. Murray said, "I think it's just my mindset, my ability to fit in to a lot of different cultures, fit in and be successful in a lot of places." And then Murray added, "I think just creating good relationships with everyone in this organization from top to bottom will give me great success, and I'm just excited to keep building those relationships. Once you have really good chemistry as a team, as a coaching staff, and an organization, the sky is the limit." Murray sees the ability to make that happen is at the core of his passion for the game. He said, "Sensing a lack of appreciation by others for his abilities has been a factor as well." Murray said, "I felt like coming out of high school unranked, one Division I offer, thinking about going the JUCO route, I think that just built my love for basketball even more. I know I have a lot to learn to do and a lot to grow in my development, but I'm just excited to develop my game even more here." Moving now to Dear Abby. The headline says, "Ex takes up residence in couple's driveway." "Dear Abby, I love my husband, but I'm getting tired of being a second-class citizen in my home. It started when we bought a van from a friend of mine. We talked about different things we could do with it, fix it up a little and sell it or use it for a vacation. But somewhere along the line, it was suggested that we let my ex, Paul, buy it from us because he's homeless and chooses to let everyone else take care of him. The van is now fixed. Paul lost his job and is now living in the van in my driveway. The problem is he doesn't stay in the van. He crashes on my couch, uses my electricity, water, etc., and now eats my food. I told my husband this is not healthy for my mental well-being. My husband and I own our own business, and Paul has now become involved in that, too. My husband says he can use the help, and it gives Paul money to move. The only problem with that is my ex doesn't use the money for bills. He blows it on junk he doesn't need. I'm tired of raising a 41-year-old grown man. Help." Signed, Fed Up in Oklahoma. And Abby responds, "Dear Fed Up, you are not a second-class citizen. This arrangement seems crazy. Because it is interfering with your marriage, tell your husband the situation is affecting your mental health and insist upon a deadline by which Paul will be out. Guests, like fish, start to stink after 3 days, and Paul has exceeded that by far. He has a van, so whether or not he has saved enough for a place of his own, he won't be without shelter. Your mental health is more important than your husband having an extra hand in the business." And the second and final letter begins, "Dear Abby, I have several creative friends who have either written a book or made a music CD. I get asked to read or listen to these creations and submit an online review. The book was written about a very rough divorce, and my friend described her ex using some gossipy and awful information that I knew was not true. She placed all the blame on her ex when it was she who committed adultery, a fact she conveniently left out of the book. The music CD was not to my liking either. My friend cannot sing. How do I handle these review requests? So far, I've simply not submitted a review because I'm not going to lie or give a bad one. But what do I say when they ask?" Signed, Critical Critic. And Abby responds, "Dear Critic, tell your author friend that while she may be a talented writer, you are not comfortable endorsing her book because it is being used as a weapon to make her ex-husband look bad. Point out that if her book succeeds, he could retaliate by suing her for libel, and you want no part of it. As to your musician friend, all you need to say about the CD is that it is, quote, clear the singer has music in their soul. In the future, when you are asked to write a review, decline by stating that because you are a friend, you cannot give an unbiased review, period." And that concludes the reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Monday, June 27th. You can access a recording of today's reading and readings of other newspapers at the website iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to Iris, your Iowa Radio Reading Information Service.